Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, I'm pleased to welcome founder of the communication store, Julieta Dexter. Julieta established a communication store 23 years ago, and it now has an income of £16 million and employs 200 people, 180 in London and 20 in the US. The communication store has remained independent and is a specialist consultancy operating in fashion, beauty and lifestyle. Julieta, welcome to the PR Moment podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
You founded the communication store 23 years ago, as I say. That's a remarkable length of time to have kind of had the same job. Are you proud of that, or do you look back with a few regrets of what might have been if you'd tried something different?
I am very proud of that, actually. I'm interested in things that stand the test of time. I'm sure you know the story of the tortoise and the hare. And I love the idea of legacy, of loyalty, and having to maintain integrity over a long period of time. So I feel very proud of what the company has achieved, actually, over the last 23 years. And sometimes I've thought that maybe if I'd worked in other companies, larger, smaller, bigger corporations, that I would have learned different skills that I don't have, perhaps, being a sort of entrepreneur founder, if you will. But on the flip side of that, we look after over 120 brands. And I've had the most extraordinary insight into so many businesses of the fantastic clients that we have that I feel that I really have a very sort of broad understanding of our industry and also of the industry of fashion and beauty and lifestyle that we work in.
And have you kept... I don't know if renewing yourself is the right phrase, but I mean, even I've been running PR Moment about 10 years now. You know, occasionally I have the odd thought, blimey, I haven't quite enough of this, but you know what I mean? I wouldn't mind. But you have to reinvigorate yourself, but that's a holiday, or have you not found that? Have sort of challenges kept finding you, or have you had to go and find them?
I'm not very good at holidays. weakness number one. I don't think I've had a switch-off holiday in 25 years.
Wow.
And that's okay for me, actually.
Okay. Define a switch-off holiday. What does that mean?
Well, a switch-off holiday would be not looking at your emails or taking calls or sort of keeping your eye there.
How many calls have you had? On an average two-week holiday, if we're calling it that, how many calls do you reckon you take?
Oh, lots.
Multiple a day. Okay. Right.
I'm not going to be specific.
No,
but I definitely
look at my
emails in the morning. Right. My family understands. Sort of, mum's doing emails in the morning, emails sort of before dinner on holiday or whatever.
Right.
So I'm always there. But we've also decided that as a family we have to have activity holidays, because if I'm sitting on a beach, I just think about the business.
Right.
And my incredible business partner of 19 years, Tom Koenig Oppenheimer, he left the business in 2015. He retired from the business. And he had got to the point, actually, where he was just a little bit jaded by it all. He was
right.
Just a bit tired. I think he was looking for something else in his life, and he...
I can understand that.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Completely. And actually, he was utterly incredible, because rather than hang on and sort of become sort of, I don't know, unhappy in the business, or, you know, people tell your energy how passionate you are about something. He just took me around the corner for lunch one day and said, by the way, we're never having this conversation again. I'm done. I'm cooked. And I was so respectful of that, and in such admiration of him as a human being, that he knew when he'd had enough.
Right.
For me, that just hasn't happened. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. First of all, I'm very driven by the excitement of growing an organization. And the company just keeps changing every year. You have to relook at the structure, particularly in communications today that are so fast-paced. I find that incredibly exciting and challenging, of having to reinvent all the time to stay relevant, to stay current, to be innovative. The brands that we represent are never-endingly interesting to me. We have constantly got new clients coming to us that I find very stimulating. And I think over and above that, one of my biggest job satisfactions is is the community that we've built, the staff force at TCS, which, as you said, is just shy of about 200 people. And that's an extended family for me. And the sense of responsibility that I feel for those people, to help those people through their lives, pay their salaries, kids through school, babies, all sorts, is probably the anchor for me. I feel huge sense of duty to those people.
Okay. Well, duties can't necessarily turn off or escape from, is putting it too emotively, but it's you obviously from your side currently it's a really positive thing, but it must be difficult for all founders of a business if they want to get after. It's often something with other guests we've had on the show, it's there's not necessarily with a job there's an end point, isn't there, or an exit, whereas if you run a business there isn't necessarily, which is I suppose actually in your case you had a partnership, so it kind of worked out for the best, frankly.
Yes, and I think it's not my job, it's who I am.
Okay.
It sort of defines how I live my life, and I love it.
So how did that come about? I don't want to dwell on this question too long, but it's very central to who you are, this business then, isn't it? Has that evolved, or has it sort of always been like that?
I only started a business from an ethical point of view. So for me, there are so many extraordinary people in this industry, hugely successful agencies. And so when I started the business, it was not because I felt that I could do it better. Right. I felt, who am I? These people are just brilliant. You know, there are some extraordinary companies out there. For me, it was more...
Do you mean PR firms now, or do you mean brands?
Advertising, okay. Digital, right. All sorts. Yeah. Just, you know, in our sort of service industry of communications, of marketing disciplines in general.
But you didn't go and get a job with one? Without pointing out the obvious, so that's...
I worked in two or three PR and communications companies, first of all in the fundraising sector and then in the fashion and beauty sector.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. You had respect for these other businesses. It was about... it was an ethical decision to launch the business. So I'm just trying to work out what that genesis was, what was behind it.
So to a degree, I think sometimes when you are in a workplace, you learn more from what you don't like than what you do like. Yeah. And you learn more from challenging days. And I don't know whether you've ever seen a movie called The Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
A very successful movie. And I was very shocked that such an incredible and exciting industry still had this kind of cultural behaviours. A little bit the blame game, a little bit the throwing a handbag at your head, you know, that sort of everyday business practice. And I was very shocked by that. And I started the company because I wondered whether you could be successful in business, make a living, and try and be a really decent human being to those around you.
Right.
And so I started the company off the back of that, from an ethical perspective.
Sort
of business culture. That's what I find interesting.
Right. Now, your father died in your last year of Cambridge. That must have no doubt been a very traumatic time. How did that influence your choice of career?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I got a bit lost at that stage in my life. My father died overnight, so it was very, very sudden. And he'd always said that I should maybe go into his business. He was in insurance in Italy. And about 3 years before he died, he had the opportunity to sell his business. He had three competitive insurance companies trying to buy his business, and so he decided to do that. And so that idea sort of collapsed, if you like.
Yeah.
And what surprised me a lot at his funeral was how many people were there. All these people that I didn't have a clue who they were. And more recently, I found the sale document of his business when he sold his company.
Right.
And in a very similar way, actually, that I had already done, because I didn't know where this document was. He had given some share options, if you will, some skin in the game to 8 of the people that worked for him and who had been very loyal to him. So what I subsequently understood was that all of these people were people who he had worked with in business and in other areas of his life. And I think that that was a huge inspiration for me to try and build something, to try and be a decent person, and to work hard and make something of life, knowing that it could be taken away from you so quickly.
Right.
And I think that was very much a driver for me.
Sort of almost a legacy in a way.
Yes, I think so. And I think he would think that my world is mad.
Yeah.
He died pre-internet, so he would have no understanding of
what
this is.
You were saying that he'd always thought you would go into a similar line of work, and where you've ended up is obviously massively different from that. So what was your journey from, I suppose, Cambridge and I think you were saying potentially a legal profession and things like that, going into those sorts of areas, and then you ended up in public relations?
Well, I think that, like a lot of things, it was luck rather than judgment, to be honest with you. I think that was his expectation, that I would go into management consultancy or banking or private banking or insurance like he was. And I think that I was a little bit lost at that time. I tried to go back to Italy to help my mother sort things out after his death. And then I decided that, you know, potentially there was a need to change the world. So I tried to look for a job in PR, in fundraising and in the charitable sector. And after about a year, I'd helped raise about, I think, £100,000, which I saw as an abject failure. And I was very lucky that I worked as a secretary for this illustrious philanthropic committee. And on that committee were a number of people who took one look at me and said, "What are you doing here? You're not going to change the world here. You've got to get out there and have a career. And why don't you go into the communication of brands in the luxury goods sector, etc." I speak French, I speak Italian, and they said, "You could be useful around here, so go and get a job in those industries and make a career and then give back to charity and give back."
Wow.
So that was exactly how it happened.
Okay. Now, just we'll talk about your partnership and how that came about in a little while. But the what I love about your story is that I think people often try and give the impression anyway that their sort of businesses grow on some sort of linear path. But from hearing you speak, I get the impression anyway that's not quite the story of the communication store. So when have you experienced some tough times and how have you bounced back from them?
It makes me a little bit vulnerable to answer this question because maybe they just know how to run a business better than I do.
Well, or for not as long.
Yes, possibly too.
Yeah.
I think that you can live your life in three ways: to be an optimist, a realist, or a pessimist.
Right.
And I'm a realist. And I think that real life... Think of a relationship that you might have had. Has it just been perfect all the time? Or were there ups and downs and bumps in the road? And I believe that everything is cyclical, everything is rhythmic, nothing is linear, nothing is forever.
Right.
And so if we are still humans and we're not robots yet, even our own energies, you referenced it earlier in our conversation, how do you not get jaded? How do you not sort of... You know, the energy starts to wane a bit. That's normal humanity. That is reality.
Yeah.
And so in the history of the 23 years of the company, it hasn't gone in the straight line. You know, you plot a graph and you sort of go from the bottom left to the top right.
And you get a few things wrong.
And it doesn't always just go like it does in the textbooks.
No.
And that has been my reality. Sometimes because I've made a mistake myself. Sometimes because there are macroeconomic situations that I couldn't have done anything about at all. So the crisis in 2009, yes, I didn't predict that, like so many other people. And did that have an impact on our business? Yes, it absolutely did. Sometimes I've made some catastrophic decisions about recruiting people and appointing people to our company that were just not right for our business, and that has had an impact. It's slowed us down. And so I think that over such a long period, as you say, those things have been huge challenges to find the depth of yourself to persevere, keep rigorous, keep working hard, keep your confidence, keep your faith that you're actually on the right path. And I think it's very easy, particularly when things happen that are not your fault, to feel like, oh, you know, like a victim in some way. And I think that you have to dig deep. There's a part of my character which our business coach talks quite a lot about in the office, which is competitive rebellion. And I think that is part of my personality. So if things are going badly or there's a tiny brand to build alongside the big one, the David and Goliath, or the situation that, oh, you know, this one's really going to take us down, it gives me this impetus of, come on, we can really do this now.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel
you kind of like the fight. You're a competitive person.
I like the fight. I'd like to say that it's maybe gentle competition rather than ruthless competition. But I almost really feel now that this is just the beginning of the company. That was like a dress rehearsal. Like, we've learned a lot.
So the last 23 years
yes,
have been a dress
rehearsal. Exactly. So there's still a lot of energy and excitement in me for what this business could become. And the biggest driver of that for me is in the thought leadership of, as I said, an ethical business in communications. And I don't need to tell you how under the spotlight the communications industry, the social media industry is in terms of the responsibility of how we're using social media today. So that plays right into my heartland.
Yeah, it's perfect positioning for right now. So does that mean that you've, when you say you're sort of starting or using the, or starting again after 23 years, or are you using what you've, that sort of bunch of stuff that you've learned over the last 23 years to inform the future, or is everything now so new that a decent proportion of that stuff is no longer relevant?
It's both.
Right.
And that's what I find so exciting. It's like the wisdom of experience and all the innovation and the novelty and the newness of something that wasn't there 20 years ago, and how can you marry those two things to have a point of view.
Right.
And when I started the company, I had this idea about the four C's of the communication store, that everything we should do should be clever, or try to be clever, be considered, be considerate, and maybe countercultural.
Right.
And those were my four C's. Everything we did, everything we wrote, everything we tried to achieve as a company on behalf of our clients should be those four things. And more recently, we've sort of done some work on our values and our ethics, and our values are now to be passionate, to be wise, to be strong, and to be caring, actually. And I think that that's where the female thing sort of comes in, of having empathy and compassion in the workplace,
right.
Thinking about other people around you, be it your suppliers, your staff, your clients. So I feel very excited that the world is coming my way.
I can tell. Go on. I don't know whether you deliberately avoided my question, but when you've had those tough times, how have you bounced back from them? Is it waiting for the economy to turn? Is it, I don't know.
In that situation with the crisis, I'm very happy to tell you what we did. We immediately stripped out cost in the business around inanimate objects, i.e. everything that wasn't a job. Flowers, anything you want.
Right.
Paper clips, you name it. Taxi journeys, we just stripped it as far back as we could to basically look after our community and the jobs that we were giving. And then from the January to the March, we were having endless conversations with clients who were saying, oh, look, we're in a terrible crisis economically. We're going to have to reduce our fees. We're not going to be able to do this.
A bit like now with Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And some people use it as an excuse, by the way. And so I decided that we would preemptively go to our clients and offer to cut their fees.
Okay.
And as a small business person, what I describe as an entrepreneurially led business, i.e. with no investment or funding, I started the business with 600 quid. We had some money in the bank because we hadn't sort of taken out all our profits at the end of every year. So we were in a pretty positive cash position. So we were able to reduce our fees with our clients. We were able to continue the service to the clients. And I asked the clients for just one thing in return. We'll keep doing our work. We'll reduce our fees. We'll keep here, you know, being here for you through this critical time. As long as when the governor of the Bank of England tells us that we're out of recession, we go back to the original fees plus 5%.
Right.
And that's when clients really show their true colours. Because every single one did that except for one.
Okay.
And so that was when really
you get to know each other better. It was such a long recession. Maybe the person you told that to had long since disappeared. I don't know.
No, same person. Anyway. Same person, but back to my business ethics.
Yeah, fine. Okay. Right, that's it. So in essence, taking a long-term view is kind of what you're doing now.
Absolutely. Yep. In essence, taking a long-term view and, you know, to answer you an even more specific question, when we've really struggled, it's awake at 2:45 in the morning in a cold sweat trying to work it out.
I was going to ask you that because you clearly have a very considered, calm, confident manner to you. But do you ever just take 5 minutes and go and lock yourself in a room and, I don't know, kick the wall or have a little scream or something? Or are you always consistent, calm and considered?
Have you ever met my husband?
No.
There's been headstands. There's been headstands in meetings. There have been headstands in the loo in the office.
Right.
Yeah, I do a lot of things to just get rid of that energy.
Right.
But I think that I'm a fairly pragmatic person. I'm not a very emotional person.
No, okay.
And I'm actually in any situation much more concerned. Actually, it sounds rather sort of pathetic, but I'm really concerned about the wider community, what's going to go on here, rather than throwing my own toys out of the pram. It's not my place.
Okay. The communication store has retained a pretty specific focus on fashion, beauty and lifestyle PR. To grow the business, well, like lots of other PR firms, you must have been tempted to sort of broaden the number of verticals you worked across. But in the main, you decided to not do that. I'm just intrigued why.
Right back at the beginning, I decided to call the company the Communications Store rather than Dexter PR. Yeah. And at that time, I don't know if you remember that, but there were a lot of agencies that sort of called themselves after the name of the founder.
Yeah.
And I felt really strongly that that was a flawed business model. Because if you got a few clients, I mean, you mentioned to me recently around, you know, scale. How do you scale a business like yours if you don't start breaking out into other sectors? And I felt that naming the company after myself would mean that it wouldn't scale. So that was a big decision for me because I think otherwise people want founder, they want the leader, they want the most senior person in the business. And I had this idea of a partnership, really. In my mind, I do a lot of things visually. It was like an umbrella with lots of spokes in it. You know, the umbrella fails if it hasn't got all of those spokes working together. And that I would bring under this umbrella called the Communications Store the best people in the business. And Tom Koenig-Oppenheimer, my business partner right at the beginning, was one of those spokes. And then in 2002, Daniel Marks joined me, who in my perspective is probably the best fashion PR and expert in the world in communications. And many others have joined us. So we now have a leadership team of about 17 people. And so that's worked. It's allowed us to scale in a way that you might go to a firm of lawyers or accountants, and your senior partner doesn't mean that you're waiting for the other senior partner to come and look after you. You're perfectly happy with that person because they're the best at what they do. And what has subsequently happened is that I think we really are experts in our field. We're not an inch deep and a mile wide. We're, you know, hopefully an inch wide and a mile deep. And when I look at Daniel working and the experience and the knowledge that he has in the fashion industry, he's second to none. So that's, I think, why we've kept into the sector-specific space that we are. We have broadened out the services that we offer those clients, because over the years, once clients start to trust you, they say, and can you do this for me, and this for me, and this for me? And I'm a big believer of not trying to be all things to all people. Don't pretend that you're the best at experiential marketing if you know damn well that there's somebody next to you that can do it better than you do. So we work with a lot of partners, but we call ourselves brand guardians. We call ourselves brand ambassadors. And when I think of some of the meetings that I've just had in the last week, of people really trusting our opinion, and that's what we hold on to. And I think that's because we have remained hopefully good at what we do rather than try to spread ourselves too thinly.
Sure. I get that. I mean, the obvious thought I had on that was from a conflicts perspective, but I suppose that's the old one about when does a specialism become a conflict? Is it you've got these partners within the business, that's how you manage those potential conflicts so they don't happen?
Yes, and there is so much crossover today, because the traditional hierarchy of marketing disciplines is over. And you have advertising agencies trying to move into PR. You have publishing houses trying to become branded content houses. You know, we're all sort of slightly chomping at each other's ankles for bits of business. And some brands, by the way, they love that. They kind of throw the problem in the air in front of a multi-agency meeting and say, right, the best man wins. You know, you guys decide who can do this better. And we have been given advertising briefs off the back of a PR idea. That has happened on a number of occasions.
An independent PR firm of your size must have had a few offers over the years, hasn't it? Or at least a few potential buyers sniffing around. How come you've decided to remain independent?
I think, honestly, the right strategic partner, acquirer, investor hasn't presented him or herself.
Right.
And largely, I think that is because, you know, in the aftermath of WPP, this monolith of multiple agencies that have been acquired, that more traditional formula to me of selling to a big networked agency and finding yourself in an earnout situation where you're then going to have to guarantee a margin, an escalating margin, probably over 3 years, back to my point about reality, has never really seemed that exciting to me.
Sure.
And second of all, as I hope I've managed to express, the Communication Store is a company that has this sense of longevity, and part of my quest is an ethical one. It's not just a financial one, and I haven't met somebody who is going to allow us to do that and to remain true to that.
Right. I don't know what you. I think about your comment on the aftermath of WPP there, but we'll see what they say about that one. But
well, I think it's just, you know, I mean, I'm not saying anything that's not in the newspapers. All of those acquisitions, and now that's going to have to be all broken out again.
Yeah. Okay. Which may mean there's a few less buyers in town, frankly.
But, perhaps.
Or more, I suppose you could look at it that way. Actually, let's go back. I just want to talk to you a little bit about Tom Keimer Oppenheimer, who's your founder of the business. You founded it on your own first, and then Tom joined. Is that right?
That's
right. I got that right. But not very long after you founded it.
Correct. Absolutely.
First year.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Long-term business partnerships, I'm always quite intrigued by them. One of the reasons I should say that I'm intrigued by them is because my dad had a business partner, and that didn't quite work out in the end. Didn't get too messy, but that in the end they ended up, enjoying the end of the partnership, shall we say. So I'm always interested when I see people go into partnership, into business with each other who don't necessarily know each other that well. How did you meet, and why did you decide to go into business together?
We met in one of the agencies that I'd worked for, and Tom was there.
Right.
And we very much shared a a vision of life, of work, of how we wanted the workplace to be. And sometimes when we were having really dark days, I would say to Tom, don't worry, Tom, I'm going to start an agency and I'm going to do it this way. And so we very much sort of became, well, what happened then to be lifelong friends from that, in this sort of shared endeavour.
Where did you meet? Which agency?
It was called Phyllis Walters.
Okay.
And Tom and I became very, very firm friends, and we were young and we were naive and full of energy to do something. And I knew that this business would be much, much, much more successful with him in it,
right,
than with him not in it. We are quite different in our skills, so we never had the problem of, you know, fighting for the same bit of the journey or the work. And actually, I think that the magic was around the energy between the two of us. When you are in the presence of two people who actually love each other and adore working with each other, It really is, I think it was magnetic and exciting for everybody around us, because it was just great fun.
Okay.
And that is something that, you know, if I've ever had a free lunch or a gift from God, it was Tom.
Right.
And we are still very, very firm friends now. And if that wasn't enough luck, Daniel then joined us in 2002, and we were like, oh no, here we go, two's company, three's a crowd. But actually, since Tom's left the business, the relationship between Daniel and I is incredibly strong. We've worked very hard at that.
Right.
We've done quite a lot of business coaching to work on partnership and what that means and how it manifests itself every day. And I suppose the...
But you know, I mean, he joined in 2002. Right, so I mean, he's been a long time.
Yes, but we hadn't just been alone together.
Yeah, okay.
And he'd got a very different part of the company's development than I did. So we had to sort of learn how to be partners without Tom and assume different roles and look at our roles. And I think that, you know, diversity in the workplace is obviously on the agenda at the moment. But these two gay men, both married to different men, and I was the day wife, the dynamic between us could not have been and is not any stronger, and I am deeply blessed to have those two men next to me.
Brilliant. Now, I'm interested, and clearly from your last answer, I can see the exit, I suspect, wasn't a particularly controversial one. But just from a day-to-day perspective, Tom's left the business, as I understand it. How did the two of you go about managing that process? Because I think a lot of business partners have is that they reach the end of the road for whatever reason, and there's a tendency for people to believe those moments are always quite difficult. But I get the impression it wasn't really for you guys.
We were lucky in a sense. First of all, Tom was brave enough and extraordinary enough to know when he'd had enough, so right. He didn't hang around. I think a lot of people hang around and start, you know, not being that constructive or not being that passionate, and that has an energetic impact on the business. So that was the first thing. Back to my ethics bandwagon. Had Tom and I fallen out after 19 years of building a business together, I would have seen that as a failure on my personality, that it would have come down to, you know, an ugly negotiation or trying to, you know, whatever. And at that time, we were very lucky because we actually did have a potential acquirer at the table who had given us a valuation for our business.
Right.
So that was very lucky for us because we didn't have to sort of start self-determining the value of our business. So that was very helpful.
Right.
And it was Tom's...
So you had a third party, this is what it's worth.
Yeah, we had a piece of paper on the table that said, this is what your business is worth.
Right.
And Tom actually had the idea of... the company needing at that time of its growth a chairman. And so we appointed somebody called John Hoffman to be the chairman of our business. And Tom said, let's get somebody to be the mediator between us and to help us through this process so we don't make a mess of it.
Right.
And that was a very, very successful strategy. John turned out to be somebody who could, you know, be rigorous with both of us, make sure that we were on the right path all the time, and was very empathetic to our values and our culture. And in the end, we took our staff on an away day and night to the New Forest. And we woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and went for a walk in the New Forest. And I'd written the number on a piece of paper. And halfway through the walk, I gave it to him and he goes, yeah, that's great.
Well, I bet you're not going to tell me what that number was.
No, but... I'm not. But I can tell you that he is the godfather of one of my children. And we are very much in each other's lives. And I think,
brilliant.
You know, it wasn't without its difficulties. There are always moments when lawyers particularly get in the room.
I bet.
But... my friendship with Tom is of greater value than any profit margin.
Brilliant. You guys had a chief creative officer in Daniel Marks long before most PR firms decided to invest in senior creative talent. How has that helped the communications store come up with ideas?
It sounds like we were great innovators, and I'm going to tell you the absolute truth, which, my goodness, this one's had some bumps in the road.
Right.
Daniel... in the role that he's played in the fashion industry, is a highly creative person. And actually, the skills that he's honed mean that the creativity, the problem solving, the strategic application that he brings to any problem across any brand has been super valuable. So actually, it was sort of happening organically to us that Daniel was taking on this sort of CCO role,
right,
because he'd been with us for so long already. We have, with some successes and some failures, brought sort of the traditional creative director role, CCO role, into the business. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, insofar as a creative officer in an advertising agency does do a different job and might not have an understanding, yeah, of the sensitivities of PR and the more nebulousness, if you like, of how PR strategies can evolve. So I'd like to pretend that we were great front runners, but it's actually been a very complex thing to get right. And as the media landscape and the communications channels have evolved, getting that right has become an increasing priority. But we're just very lucky that Daniel is there at a very senior level to be that person and fulfill that role.
Okay, I think you're right, because when I look at sometimes to great fanfare, there have been creative hires within public relations as a sector that have come from Adland, and they normally, 6 months later, it's all gone a bit quiet and you work out that they've left the business. So it does seem to be it's a difficult transition to make, isn't it, from that advertising agency to a PR agency, because you probably need that background in public relations to be a success as a creative, or maybe you did anyway, need to be a success creatively with an PR firm.
I think you're right, and therefore Daniel, having had the PR background,
okay,
and then honing the creative skills,
yeah,
is the way that it's worked for us.
Maybe that's changing as things become more integrated, or maybe it's not. We shall see. So finally for me, what's the plan now then for the communication store and Julieta Dexter?
So there are a number of things that we're working on as a business. We've opened the business in the US, and so we now have 25 plus people in the US. And so again, to your point about, you know, do you ever get bored or jaded? No, it's like starting all over again,
right,
and learning the differences in the US market. But it does really allow us to look after brands much more globally. So the US is a big strategic focus for us, and so far so good. The second thing that is very much growing for us is we have appointed a senior director of purpose, responsibility and sustainability.
Right.
That to me is something that is going to only grow in brand land. And having started that process externally about 2+ years ago, properly in the business, we had lots of brands saying, yeah, thanks, but no, we're fine, thank you very much. And now those doors are opening,
really?
So fast.
I thought 2 years ago that brands would still have been open to having that conversation, but it's taken a bit of time.
All shapes and sizes. I think that some brands in the consumer space know that they might not be as sustainable or responsible as we or the millennial might like them to be. And that's going to be a big, long, hard fix. And so I think sometimes there's a little bit of burying the head in the sand. But that conversation is dialing up on our agenda a great deal. And we're very, very lucky with the team that we've got. And I'm very excited about that because I can see a huge growth path for us. And I hope that we're sort of thought leaders and front runners, not only because of the work that we're doing for our clients, but actually how we are ethically as a business in terms of trying to have a triple bottom line ourselves. And those are really the things that for the company, we've got a 3 to 5 year plan, which we're very excited about in terms of not getting bigger, but getting better at what we do. And for myself, that will be my focus. And I have also written a book about The Honest Business is the name of the book so far. And it really is about whether you can be successful in the long term in business, although I hasten to add success is relative. I don't sort of see myself as a successful person in any way at all. But the book is really about exploring tips for young people who might want to become entrepreneurs. It's quite difficult if you want to become an entrepreneur to know where to look for guidance. Mm. There aren't so many mentors, and certainly when you say to people, people's parents in the creative industries, then you say, oh, I'm going to go and, you know, work as a makeup artist, or I'm going to go and work as, I don't know, a PR. They sort of, in certainly my parents and my mother would say to me, well, can't you get a proper job? And this is a proper job. And as I was telling you, when we arrived today, I was at Downing Street yesterday talking about exactly that. Is Great Britain a great place to be entrepreneurial in the creative industries, in the media industries? We're fantastic at film. We're fantastic at technology. We're fantastic at communications. We're blessed to have the English language. And I'm not going to get into a Brexit discussion with you. But I'm excited about being part of a movement that that really does encourage young people to come into the workplace and be entrepreneurial and enjoy these fantastic industries. So I'm hoping that my book will be a how-to to dodge some of the bullets and have a successful and happy career.
And how is it? Is it? Have you written it? Are you halfway through? Where are you up to?
I've written it with a wonderful ghostwriter in the US called Val Frankel, and we've downloaded many hours of conversation, much like these ones, and she has absolutely brilliantly structured a book together. Wow. And I think last weekend we put the final full stop on the, I think it's, she told me it were 75,000-80,000 words.
Wow.
And
it's
ready to go. It's with the publisher. We're waiting for his feedback. And I'm very excited about that book, and that it might just, you know, inspire some people to find out how to do it and how not to do it.
Brilliant. Julia, so that's inspirational stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.